just had a remiss. Glenn and Nick are both on with us. I think, guys, the common ground here in terms of your relative positions is that it is a really it's a serious problem when we are arming our police with the first option of killing as opposed to the first option of subduing. The second problem, and that problem can be solved. There are guns that shoot pepper spray that immobilize a person, and there are stun guns, which should be the first option used. And there's another option, even in the firearms. So many of the cases where the police have said they had to shoot someone, like they shot the mentally handicapped boy in Los Angeles. They said that his mannerisms, his motions, suggested to them that he might be trying to grab their gun, so both officers unloaded their handguns in him and killed him. Is they make handguns that recognize palms, and they're keyed to a specific hand, and they won't discharge unless they're in the hand of the person to which they're keyed, which would completely eliminate that that issue. So training is the problem. I think we are training police to use lethal force as a primary option. As Scott said during the break, so many police are becoming militant. And let me just finish what Scott's comment was, and then I'll love to hear your reaction. Scott's comment during the break is that police ought to be trained to defuse. And instead, way too often, their attitude doesn't cause the people to be more relaxed, but causes them to be more on edge. So it's part of the training, part of the indoctrination, part of the culture. And the culture and the indoctrination and the training are all, as well as the equipment, are all militarizing something that shouldn't be militarized.
You guys are actually both wrong. I'll tell you why.
Okay.
If the store owner, instead of calling police, wouldn't be afraid to unload his weapon into that big guy that wanted to steal his stuff, mm-hmm. they wouldn't need for any police or anything else. He's got video to back him up, and the police there anyway after the crime is committed anyway. So, therefore, if laws will be changed in a way where owners would not be afraid to protect their life and their property, then there would be not as much need for police.
Yeah, there is a huge advocacy in the Bill of Rights for allowing everyone to have no restrictions whatsoever on keeping and bearing arms. Now, the Bill of Rights is really focused on the government, to keeping the government honest by making sure that the people have their have a means to keep the government from being oppressive, as the government is turning out to be in Ferguson. But it's also is the realization that we all should take responsibility. And I agree with you, but now I don't think that in this particular case, the shop owner would have been justified in shooting Brown, and that he would have to have thought that the fear for his life, and I've watched the video, he would be indicted, and whether or not he would be convicted or not, I don't know, or held innocent.
I wouldn't worry about his, I mean, even if it's not for his life, you take my scissors away, it doesn't, or my lighter, it doesn't matter, it's mine, you have no right. And
that's
if
right.
You don't stop, you get the bullet.
Well,
that's it.
While I agree with you that, you know, the shop owner would probably be able to shoot somebody, do you think that like things would be any better for the shop owner if he shot this guy for a $50 box of cigars?
That's right. But he wouldn't have shot him for the $50 box of cigars. He would have shot him for the assault. And if he shot him for the $50 box of cigars, he'd go to jail. If he shot him to defend himself against the assault, then that is a different story. But the video, I don't think, justifies either. And, you know, but the very threat, and that's why in Texas, for example, there is less robbery than there is in the state of California, because in Texas, a disproportionate number of people are packing weapons. They have a concealed weapon in the state of Texas, and therefore there's a lot less robbery in the state of Texas, because the robber knows that if I steal that box of cigars, it might cost me my life, and that's a pretty high price to pay.
Scott is right. It probably wouldn't be better for the store owner to shoot the guy for the. But how did we get to a point where the store owner would actually risk his life by shooting the guy for the pack of the cigarettes? And the way we got there is because there's many more people just like this store owner who's afraid, who if
right.
any in every business would do something
correct.
What I just suggested, that would be normal. There would be
yeah.
no store owner there that will be afraid to do such things. So
yeah, I think there's three issues here, all of which are important, none of which we've talked about. One is, what causes someone like Mike Brown to think that he is justified to walk into a store and steal? What is this entitlement mentality that causes him to not only do it, but to gloat about it, walking down the middle of the street carrying the box of stolen cigars? What causes that mentality? And I say that it's the entitlement mentality of our government. We are constantly giving people things that they have not earned, that they have not worked for. And it's a pretty thin line between the taking from the government that which you have not earned and worked for, and taking it from a store owner. So I think that's a huge part of the problem here that no one wants to address. What was Mike Brown's mentality in stealing? What was his mentality in assaulting the store owner? And then you get to the breakdown of morality within the educational system. We don't teach good judgment anymore. It's not part of political correctness. So Mike Brown was indoctrinated, as well as the looters are indoctrinated, without moral fabric. They can't exercise good judgment. It's a huge part of the problem.
Well, I don't think anyone will disagree with what you just said, even Scott. But I have a question about Torah, if you don't mind.
Oh, please.
In the story, well, first of all, a comment about the Tara mm-hmm. website with an audio that you can download.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I suppose I may be not even in the position to make this comment because, well, you get what you get usually and you don't
yes.
know if it. That's how it is.
Yes.
And I suppose I probably shouldn't, but I'm still going to do it.
Okay.
Make a comment on the quality of sound.
Yeah.
It's so hard to understand that audio
yeah.
is, I mean, but I suppose if there's nothing better than that, then,
yeah, the choice to actually record it with voices, to read it and record it, which we did with the Prophet of Doom. That whole book was available at MP3, and it was because a friend of mine and I read through it, and we played the various voices in it and read through the entire thing. And then I spent the time to edit it to make it an audio book. The investment of time required to do that is gargantuan. You can't even imagine how much time you have to spend, and not only reading it, but also in the edit process. And so this is an automated computer voice that Don has used, and it is better than not having audio. It's not as clear because you don't get the right inflection and tone that you would get with a natural reader.
If at least they would take the numbers out from it, where it would just keep on reading without, you know, 22, and Ibrahim says to, or
yeah.
23, and Sarah says,
yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the numbers are, the numbers are artificial.
Why did they even put the numbers there?
The reason is because I have the numbers in the text, and in the text, the numbers are there to help people verify whether or not this is an accurate translation so they can find it. But in the audio, you're right. The audio would be better without the numbers because it is it takes you away from the natural flow of the conversation. You know, when you're reading and you see the number, you know, Barashith 1832, if you're reading it, all you know is it's there if I want to go check, but you don't actually read it. So in the audio, I agree with you. It shouldn't have the number. Be better off without it.
So then when the God have dictated the Torah to Moshe, did he also use numbers?
No. The numbers were added, and the first time numbers were actually added to the text was in the 19th century, I believe. Could have been the late 18th century, but a religious fellow was trying to read something. He was riding on a horseback, and he said, "Boy, this would be a lot easier if I broke it into chapter and verses." And it was, I think, in the Geneva Bible that it was first done. And so, no, it not only didn't have numbers, it didn't even, the numbering and the chaptering into chapter and verse was a very late phenomenon. And I have many times even thought in the writing of Introduction to God and yada yada that I should not have them because they are distracting and because they're not part of the text itself. And my biggest concern over the numbering, Nick, is that what it causes people to do is to cite a verse out of context and to think that because they've cited a verse that it is a legitimate approach.
Just like what Paul did.
Correct.
He used the numbers to mislead people.
Yes. Now, he actually didn't. There were no numbers at that time. But what he did is he took a portion of a statement that God was making, took it out of context to twist it, and to lead to the exact opposite conclusion that God was making at the time. But Christians even do it worse than that now because they think that if they cite the chapter and verse that their thought is valid. And I always tell people, if you've got to cite something out of context, just a chapter and verse out of context, you don't have a point worth making. You to understand, you have to have context. And I think that's the biggest negative of chapter and verse, is that it removes statements from their context, and context is the dominant influence for understanding.
So
I am agreeing with you. I'm agreeing with you, Nick.
Ask you another question about Joseph. Joseph, when he was become the big voodoo daddy of the Egypt, and
okay,
he,
all right. We'll entertain that question, and we'll stay with Glenn here as well, because after we answer Nick's question, we'll probably spend a little more time on what happened in Ferguson, because I think there's more for us to learn. We'll be back with Nick and with Glenn in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're going to address Nick's second question, which was, what's the story or some issue that Nick may have about Joseph and his role in Egypt. It's interesting, by the way, to note that Joseph is actually Yosef, and Yo is a contraction of Yao, as in Yahweh, and the Seth is a contraction of Laseth, which speaks of adding and increasing. So it's Yahweh adds to, Yahweh increases is the meaning of the name. But go ahead with your question, Nick.
So after he, you know, confronted his brothers, and he sent them away to bring his father over.
Mm-hmm.
How come his father didn't ask his brothers that one question? How is it that did you lie to me? How did he came to be alive after you told me that he was eaten by animals? No questions asked.
We don't know that there were no questions asked.
And they pretty much had to clear the air on that issue before he came down with them, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Just that it's not recorded.
Yeah, I would agree. That's my view of it as well. Is the conversation occurred? It's just that conversations between men are always truncated. if all of the conversations between Yosef and his father, between the brothers themselves, if everything they had to say was added, it would be such a distraction that the message that Yahweh had to convey would be lost in the detail.
But in the message, there's like so many repeats, like absolutely,
right.
Like there's so many over, you know, and you told me not to go home, not to come back without
right.
our younger brother,
right.
so then, you know, and three times or four times that
right.
one same thing was repeated.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean,
so why would that? Why would that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a reason that Yahweh repeats things, and he does a lot of repeating. That is true. He is very repetitive. So what he's doing by not having the one thing and repeating the other three times is going out and not returning with your brother is something that God wants to say. That was the seriousness of what they did. They estranged their brother. They sold their brother into slavery. Their disassociating from their brother was the thing that God was the most distressed about, that he wanted us to know that we ought not cast our brothers into harm's way. Particularly, when you look at the nature of religion, religion enslaves people to the faith. Children after children are corrupted by religion, and they're all bound to it. And so the estranging of the brother by not bringing him back, by sending him off into slavery, that was the crime.
I got it. Yeah. Next question.
Okay, go ahead.
In Genesis 11:7, where he mixed up their speech and scattered them around the earth.
Right.
First of all, who is he coming down with to mix up their language so that they cannot understand man's evil speech?
Yeah.
Let us go down. Is he calling himself and us, or who is he going down with?
Yeah. First of all, I don't think that he himself is going down. I think he's speaking to his malach, because it's the job of his malach to do that. And you know, you're as a leader of a group, you can say, let's go take care of that. And it doesn't mean that the leader himself is going to engage. I think it is his malach, his spiritual envoys, who he is speaking to here. Now, in terms of the point that he's being made, is that confusion here is Babel. It's the Hebrew word for confusion. And the interesting thing is that Babel is also the basis of Babylon. And so the point is that the words of Babylon are confusing. Now, Yahweh's intervention here, and he definitely intervened, based upon the confusing and the corruption of Babylon and the Babylonian religion, to then confuse the language of men so that all men weren't speaking the same language, was his solution so that he would not have to re-engage with the flood. He knew that if he didn't corrupt language where people didn't speak different tongues but all one tongue, we'd be back at the events that caused the flood almost immediately. We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Nick Scott said something during the break that I want to reemphasize on the first point, and I want to go back to your second point. When you say something once, very seldom will it go from short-term to long-term memory. If you say it twice, you will at least initiate the process. The third time you say something, you can very often make that transition from short-term to long-term memory. But you're not prompting understanding. If I tell you something, though, 5, 6, 7 times, you know, don't put your hand in the fire, you're going to get burnt. Then after a while, you're going to say, I wonder why this individual is emphasizing that warning to me so many times. Perhaps maybe I should look at this person as is trying to protect me, trying to encourage me to do the right thing, where there'll be a positive consequence if I do the right thing and a negative consequence if I do the wrong thing. So understanding and memory are both teaching is a product of repetition. On the second one, it is my conclusion, and this is a wonderful question that you asked about, you know, what happened with the Tower of Babel, and what does Babel represent? Because you need to understand the correlation between Babel and Babylon and the whore of Babylon and the fact that Hasatan, the adversary's primary means to lead people away from God, has been the Babylonian religion, which is played out in Christianity today. Is that if man was effectively able to communicate without the language barriers with all men, then I think the likelihood is, and God must have thought the likelihood would be, that men's influence on men would be so great that we would be back into the dire situation that existed immediately before the flood, where humankind was so savage and so brutal and so domineering that free will would have been negated and life would have been negated. And so the only way for history to of man's belligerence and hostility to his fellow man to have at least endured for the 6,000 years that we needed to reach his return and the fulfillment of his plan was to negate the influence of human words by altering the various languages that were spoken.
Your hypothesis are maybe not wrong, but it's not written in the scripture. So all you say is coming from your own personal understanding.
Correct.
Therefore,
anyone
can trust it as much as they can trust you personally.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't go there, but I would, up to that point, you are valid. Let me just tell you something that's unique. And this is something, Nick, that I went from being frustrated by to celebrating. Almost everything in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is presented that way, where God lays out the case, and unless we really engage and think about it and make connections to other things that has happened, like I did, I was sharing the connection between Babel and Babylon and between the confusing of languages and the conditions prior to the flood. That unless we engage and make these kind of connections and seek to understand what God's trying to say, then we will be left without a basis for drawing rational and informed conclusions. He wants us to engage this way. He's encouraging us to engage this way. Now, that said, and that's the totality of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. It's all written that way. That said, should you come to a different conclusion as to why Yahweh did it, because he's inviting us to come to a conclusion as to why he did it, then that's okay. You would be correct in saying that there are possibilities for other hypotheses other than the one that I presented. And I think you would be, I would agree with you. So, is there the possibility? In fact, you even said, I said, you know, you wouldn't argue with the hypothesis that I presented. There are likely others. I'm going to give you another one. For example, Yahweh wants us individually to focus on what he had to say as opposed to what men have had to say. And so, if we do that, we're all going to be better off. And one way of encouraging that is to discourage the ability to undermine the ability of humans to affect other humans. And particularly at the site of Babel, where the religion of Babylon was conceived. There's a second reason.
Well,
I'm sure there are more.
Sometimes people do overthink things, and I think that's one of those things. Because I think it's just that simple, that much more simple than what you have presented in your hypothesis. And the answer lays right there in Genesis 11-4, where he says, "And they said, come, let us build a city and tower with the top
mm-hmm.
of the heavens and make a name for ourselves."
Right.
Now, would you be interested in leaving name for yourself after you're gone?
No.
So then, No. There's your answer right there in
yeah.
the reading, in the book.
Yeah, they were...
In Yah's eyes, I'm guessing this is a bad thing if someone
right.
wants to leave a name after themselves.
Right.
You know, building the buildings in their
right.
name.
Correct.
And
elevating themselves to the Most High. So, you know, men, and this was the nature of Babylon, is that the kings became gods. And God is saying,
came down and
right.
He
says, yeah, he says, no, you're not. Yeah, no, you're not. He's showing his animosity to politicize shrines and religious buildings where men are immortalized. So you could take what you just said, which I think is an equally valid answer to the two that I gave, and you could say what he's speaking against here is things like the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Shrine and the Shrine to Jefferson and St. Peter's Basilica in the middle of the Vatican. He's speaking against those things. He's speaking against the pyramids where men were trying to elevate themselves above the Most High and memorialize their names as if they were important. And God said, no, you're not. There you go.
I don't remember where did I actually heard. I mean, I was listening to it, MP3, and I don't remember which chapter or where I heard that. It was like in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
Genesis, and Yahweh have killed someone there, one man, and then the other man because he refused to give his seed to someone and instead had his feet dropped on the ground or something.
The story of Onan.
He killed him too. And so why was he killing? Who was he
killing? No, it's about the law of primogeniture. Onan refusing to raise up sons to his dead brother through his wife. Is that what he's talking about?
Yes.
Something. Well,
yes.
It is.
Yeah, that's the story. Go ahead, Glenn. You've got a good grasp on this.
What? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I'm glad you did. Oh, I love discussion.
It has to do with something called the law of primogeniture, where Yahweh had provided for in a case when a man and a wife had no children, no son, and the man passed away, there was no inheritor for the estate. So the brother was, you know, enjoined to commit what would otherwise be considered adultery by having sexual relations with the widow so that a son could be born and the estate could be passed on. Onan, in Christianity, it's common for this to be used as an example against masturbation or withdrawal use as a means of contraception. He did not impregnate his sister-in-law, and God, you know, struck him dead because of his greed and his refusal, you know, to comply and have mercy on his sister-in-law and conceive a son. He himself had designs on his brother's possessions. So that's the standard story the way I understand the story of Onan. And it's not about sex. It's not about masturbation or withdrawal contraception. It's about greed and refusal to comply with the law of primogeniture.
Can I just add one thing to that? That everything you said I would agree with up to the point of that the primary issue throughout the Torah is that inheritance via the covenant family is the reason that the entire universe exists. Everything exists for Yahweh to enable his covenant children to inherit everything that he has to offer. And so anytime you're dealing with family and you're dealing with inheritance, God is really serious about conveying the message that life, which is the first benefit of the covenant, eternal life, that life is based upon paying attention to the terms and conditions of the covenant. And if you are, if you fight that, if you're going to have sex with the woman but not fulfill the instruction to provide a an offspring for inheritance, then God's going to say you're as good as dead. And he will make that point time and time again, and he truncated this individual's life to make that point. If you're not willing to accept the terms and conditions of the covenant and trust Yahweh's instructions and guidance in this regard, you're as good as dead. You're walking dead, he made the point. Would you concur with that extrapolation, Glenn, or have I overthought the story?
Yeah, I attributed it to greed, but clearly it's more substantive. Yeah, that is yes. a more substantive explanation, yeah.
Okay.
Is that helpful? I mean,
Of course. You know, individual greed, I want what's good for me, and I don't care what's good for someone else. And the covenant is a really interesting phenomenon, Nick, in the sense that when you're in the covenant, rather than sensing a greed that the fewer people that are here, the larger share of what God has to offer I'm going to get, as a member of the covenant, our perspective is the antithesis of that. And since the covenant is so wonderful, we want to share it so that others choose to participate. And so self-interest over family interest was at stake here. And it's the antithesis of what those of us in the covenant experience.
Okay. Well, so now when Noah got drunk and covered himself inside of his tent, what did his son do that was so bad and mean that when Noah came to know what he did, he says that he's going to be slave to a slave of his brother?
You're hearing the music in the background, so we'll attempt to tackle that one when Shatteringness continues after the commercial break. All right, so Nick has asked us a question about, you know, what is the explanation behind issue of Noah becoming drunk and of his grandson being cursed as a result of, accordingly to the text itself, seeing him naked. So I'm going to make an attempt to provide an answer for this. First of all, here's just a crude translation of what took place, Nick. And Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank the wine and became drunk. All right, there are several places where, like Lot, for example, became drunk, and there was an act of incest committed by his daughters as a result of him being drunk. So there is a lesson here, and there's context here, where we need to understand that wrong spirit, inebriated with the wrong spirit, and drunk. When you're drunk, you're not in control of yourself. That God doesn't want us to be in that condition. And he became uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Yefesh took a garment and laid it on both of their shoulders and backward and uncovered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. So Noah woke and from his wine, and he knew what his younger son had done to him. And then he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." And he said, "Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Yeshef, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." So that's the passage that you're concerned about, correct, Nick? Nick?
Yes,
all right.
Yes.
Okay, all right. Okay, so first thing we need to understand is that we do not have Bereshith Genesis 9 extant in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we are going to fumble a little bit because we're now basing this strictly on the Masoretic. But we do have two other places that we can look. One is Kara, Leviticus 18, and then Kara 20, to understand that look upon nakedness isn't just looking. When the statement says that Noah was knew what his younger son had done to him, there was a sexual act, incest, that was in operation here. It's the same thing that happened with the story of Lot and his daughters.
Oh, so his younger grandson did him?
No, his son did, his youngest son did. And so his younger son's grandson, his younger son's son, and therefore Noah's grandson, was Canaan. And he was using this as an example of what was going to happen with Canaan. And one of the things that's, that is very prominent in many religions that grew out of this region is incest. Incest is extremely common in Islam. Muhammad himself was guilty of committing incest. Muslims have a tendency to marry nephews and nieces and cousins and the like. Incest is one of the things that God said, no, 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 that is a horrible crime. A horrible crime. And so God is defining the religious nature, the cultural nature of Canaan, and also speaking against the horrid consequence of incest, because that's what occurred here. And one of the things that's really interesting about incest and pedophilia, Nick, is that the victims of incest almost always become victimizers. And so he's also pointing our attention to this realization that here the father was incestuous. And if he was incestuous with his father, the likelihood is he was incestuous with his son. And his son would perpetuate that victimization. The victim would become a victimizer. And it happens very often. And also, Yahweh was very clear in the second instruction he gives to us that fathers corrupt their own children to the third and fourth generation. So there's a lot being said here, but it's just like the other things. You really got to stop and say, all right, what do these words collectively, and particularly when associated with other references to uncovering nakedness and drunkenness, and where they specifically speak of incest, why is God so livid against incest? And more importantly, how does this relate to Canaan and the religion and the culture of the Canaanites? A lot to learn. We'll be back.